This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where we're going to have a most interesting conversation with my two guests, Alan Powell, who needs no introduction, and Roy DeSoto, who has a background as an EMT and as many observations he wants to share about what he observed in relation to Sandy Hook. He may also, however, have remarks to make about what's gone on in San Bernardino, which is very interesting indeed, because we seem to have the combination of a somewhat sloppily conducted staged event with political consequences that appear to be the opposite of what the Obama administration might have preferred. Let's begin with a first slide from the New York Times. This was yesterday. It gives a kind of summary overview. San Bernardino, the couple who the police say killed 14 people and left 21 wounded here and stockpiled thousands of rounds of ammunition, a dozen homemade pipe bombs in their home, officials said Thursday, a sign they might have been planning further attacks. May I mention as an aside that the claim was made that the trigger mechanisms on these homemade bombs were the same as those used by the Serenova brothers in Boston, which, of course, displays the absurdity of it all because the brothers had nothing to do with it. The bombs were in black nylon backpacks. Neither of the brothers was wearing a black nylon backpack. Those were worn by the Kraft International personnel that the alternative media already pegged the day of the event. Continuing with the New York Times, the FBI is treating the Wednesday shooting as a potential terrorist act, although the agency is far concluding that it was. This is the most interesting point. The suspect's extensive arsenal, their recent Middle East travel, and evidence that one had been in touch with people with Islamic extremist views, both in the United States and abroad, all contributed to the decision to refocus the investigation. But officials emphasized they did not know what set off the attack and said they were not ready to call it terrorism. Well, look at the next slide. Rudy Giuliani didn't show any such hesitation. According to the LA Times now, Obama is planning to use executive authority to close the so-called gun show loophole that allows thousands of people to buy guns each year without a background check. Meanwhile, Obama is still saying that the massacre carried out by a devout Muslim who memorized the Quran was radicalized by terrorists and traveled to Saudi Arabia could just be an act of workplace violence. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani was somewhat more certain in his opinion, asserting that anyone who thinks Wednesday's attack isn't terrorism is a moron. Let's look at the next. Now, this is absolutely stunning. This came from InfoWars, where Paul Joseph Watson nailed it. According to the Obama White House, terrorists will stop attacking if we pass gun control laws. I mean, this is a complete manifest absurdity. California already has very strict gun control laws, but when they take the guns away from the law-abiding citizens, only the criminals or the terrorists will have guns. I think this is where it explodes in the face of Obama. The Obama administration reacted to Wednesday's shooting in San Bernardino, likely carried out by Muslim terrorists, by insisting that common sense gun laws will deter jihadists who are planning attacks. I mean, you know, when you talk about the morons and their reactions to this event, there you see right from the White House, the moron in chief. Let's look at the next slide. Islamic terrorists are not coming to America someday. The truth is they are already here. Random Islamic terror attacks are now going to be part of everyday life in America. Once upon a time, those of us warning that Islamic terrorists were already in this country were branded alarmists, but not anymore. When Mohammed Yusuf Abdulzan gunned down four U.S. Marines at a Navy and Marine Reserve Center in Chattanooga, Tennessee earlier this year, it was just a very small preview of what is coming. On Wednesday, a married couple named Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik fired at least 65 shots at a holiday office party in San Bernardino, California. 14 people were killed, 21 were wounded. Later on, hundreds of shots were exchanged as police officers pursued the vehicle that Farouk and Malik were attempting to escape in. Fortunately, Farouk and Malik are no longer a threat to any of us because they're dead. But there are thousands more radicals just like them that are already living in the country, ready to act at any time. Here's now a very interesting response from a religious, this is a Christian fundamentalist website, talking about the expansion of ISIS across the globe. And here's where you get proof that the San Bernardino massacre was not workplace related, as Obama claims. The two attackers who were killed by police, husband and wife Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, were both devout Muslims. They left remote-controlled bomb behind after the attack, which fortunately did not detonate. The triggering device was identical to the explosives used in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, which was carried out by Kraft International personnel, where the Boston police were calling out on bullhorns, "This is a drill, this is a drill," where the Boston Globe was issuing tweets announcing that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities, and where if you peered through the smoke from the puff bomb, and I was an artillery officer in the Marine Corps, I can assure you nothing that exploded there was capable of killing anyone. You could see bodies with missing limbs, but no blood. We were being treated to our first exposure of amputee crisis actors in Boston. It continues to say, it was reported both shooters wore digital GoPro cameras to record the massacre, just as ISIL members in Paris and other locations has done. Well, you know, it's really quite a fantastic story we get in Paris. We had the stunning, remarkable event that Wikipedia published an extensive article with about 20 references about the Paris attack before it occurred. We have the weird incident inside the club, where you see what purports to be blood that has been mopped into a heart configuration. Yes, there are some bodies lying there, but none of it has the look of authenticity. We have, believe it or not, a Syrian passport that turns up that led some to conclude that this was the responsibility of Syria, even though ISIS claimed credit for the attack and Syria is at war with ISIS. Sometimes our foreign policy becomes so incoherent, no one can get it straight. Consider the next slide, however. Lots of reasons here for questioning what actually took place. I mean, look at this scene. There's stuff scattered around. No one's acting with any intensity. We don't see a surge of ambulance at the scene. This was from Dr. Ewan, who publishes, maintains Fellowship of the Mind's website, and who was a contributor to Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, which, of course, Amazon.com banned after it had been up less than a month and sold nearly 500 copies, had around 80 reviews. Did they think that wasn't enough? The banning was clearly political. Where the former press spokesman for the White House, Jay Carney, had moved to Amazon.com as a senior vice president, where Jeff Bezos is a Bilderberger, recently bought the Washington Post. Jeff, like myself, graduated from Princeton, whose motto is Princeton in the Nation's Service. I don't think banning books was quite what Princeton's founders had in mind. And where Dr. Ewan has determined that Amazon actually had 20 books on Sandy Hook, they banned exactly one. The difference? The one they banned presented conclusions that were at variance with those of the government. The others did not. This isn't rocket science. It's equivalent to the Nazi book burning of the past. Now it's done electronically, especially when you have a giant bookseller like Amazon, a complete and total disgrace. Here's another slide reflecting some of the stories coming out today. San Bernardino shooting has all the signs of a staged government operation or ISIS terror attack from what we know so far. Guess what? Active shooter drills carried out every month at San Bernardino Inland Regional Center. Staff tweeted, drill started as police raid began. Down at the very bottom, you see another dear to my heart. Well, actually third from the bottom, another mass shooting attack targeting gun-free zone of California, knowing citizens would be powerless to defend themselves. California is a human shooting range. And finally, an article from Natural News, the five most important books of 2015 that have been vilified, attacked, or outright censored, which includes Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. Here on the next slide, we got further background about what's taking place here. Manipulating the masses as societal collapse accelerates. Conveniently timed mass murder terrorist attacks, completely engineered climate catastrophes, and media-fueled materialistic mass distraction mayhem all play into the hands of the power elite. The San Bernardino shootings are latest in a very long string of attacks in which authorities just happen to be engaged in a drill for just such an attack on the day the attack was happening. Isn't it interesting? The same was true of the recent Paris attacks, the Boston bomb attack, the 7/7 London attacks. And if any of you have never watched 7/7 Ripple Effect, you will be astounded in 1 hour. You go from the beginning of the planning of the terror attack as a drill with Peter Power to the actual commission of the explosions at the same tube stops where the attacks, the drills have been planned, and where Nick Kullerstrom, who's the leading expert on the London 7/7 terror attacks, cracked the case within days by discovering that the four Islamic lads who were going to be held responsible were unable to even get to the tube stops in time, assuming they'd been solicited to play roles in a drill because a train from Luton had been canceled. This is how much they game the system, play us all for saps. The terrorists couldn't have even been at the tube stops. But of course, the drill authorities were at the tube stops, and we find such fascinating phenomena as that the metal in the floor is blown upward from an explosion beneath, whereas allegedly it was caused by a backpack that had been set off inside the carriage. This is just one more absurdity of many. Continuing the 9/11 attacks and many, many more, at least 63, is it just a coincidence, really? False flag terrorists have long since been a primary weapon for the power structure to manipulate the people. Here's another. This is Obama now reflecting on what's going on. Why have mass shootings gone up 700% under Obama? It's absolutely stunning. What we know, the mainstream media is in the business of polarizing the masses. There have been multiple examples of the mainstream media manipulating news to serve an agenda. The elites use mass media to manipulate the consensus reality of society. Take last night, for example. In last night's terror, the media rushed to conclusions concerning the identities of the San Bernardino shooters. Continued Wednesday night as CNN law enforcement analyst Harry Hook, no relation to the author of this piece, speculated during Aaron Burnett out front that the perpetrators could be some right-wing group for all I know, despite the fact that little is known about them. I think that the administration realized belatedly that if these attacks were being carried out by persons who are being identified as Muslim terrorists, then much of Obama's sympathy for bringing Muslim refugees into the country, not to mention his gun control agenda, would suffer serious hits. I was on with Jeff Retz last night, and we had a most interesting conversation where Jeff was pointing out that because of the way it's being presented, that Obama was going to suffer mightily politically, and that indeed does appear to be the case, where Donald Trump has seen a tremendous surge in his support. Hillary, because of the dropout of Joe Biden, is clearly in control in the Democratic race. But where Trump, I believe, has become uncontrollable, I see no way the Republican Party, however much it may desire, is going to be able to stop him. Here's another very interesting report. This comes from the Common Sense Show. He is observing that there are 17 elements to Obama's martial law plan. 16 have already been fulfilled. Until Obama has all but erased private gun ownership, martial law and World War III will have to wait. With any more false flag shootings, private gun ownership will be in jeopardy. The 17th element of Obama's martial law prerequisites will be fulfilled, and then all hell will break loose across this country. Except, of course, gun sales are going up and up and up. All these efforts to ban guns, beginning with Sandy Hook, have caused Americans to recognize that the government is out to get our guns. It's a really fascinating development that appears to be backfiring. Here are a couple further indications. First, the chief of police of Detroit says, armed citizens deter terrorists. Not what Obama wants to hear. It's somewhat amazing to watch as police chiefs in cities that have imposed unlawful and strict gun control laws come out after the Paris jihad attacks and call for the citizens to be armed and deal with criminals and terrorists. What is equally surprising is they're maintaining strict gun control laws, which have been shown over and over not to be effective in stopping criminals from obtaining guns nor carrying out their crimes. Detroit Police Chief James Craig is the latest to jump on board. A lot of Detroiters have CPLs, concealed pistol licenses, and the same rules apply to terrorists as they do to some gun-toting thug, Craig told the Detroit News. If you're a terrorist or a carjacker, you want unarmed citizens. May I add that part of the hysteria of the reaction of the Obama administration to the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook is that I included an appendix that demonstrates that after gun bans, crimes go up. And the answer should be obvious. When you talk about common sense, if you take the guns away from the law-abiding citizens, the only ones who will continue to have guns will be the non-law-abiding citizens. Those are known as criminals or thugs or perhaps terrorists. The whole point is this gun control agenda is simply insane. And I therefore submit that this event, this latest stunt, which does appear to be a staged event for multiple reasons we will address, is backfiring massively. Here's another report. Get this. New York sheriff just issued a call to arms. A sheriff's office in upstate New York County, has issued a statement on their Facebook page, which has riled up liberals across the country. In the last year, there's been a mass shooting every day in the United States, most notably in California this week, which most observers have now tied to terrorism. The sheriff's office of Ulster County, New York, has decided to issue a call to arms for its residents in possession of legal firearms. Carry them. Use them if necessary. They made a post on their official Facebook page, which has gone viral. The comments on the post are predictably outraged, with many people suggesting the sheriff is unable to do his job if he's encouraging citizens to arm themselves. Unfortunately, for these anti-gun activists, the facts don't align with their particular worldview. Most of the casualties during mass murder incidents take place within the first few minutes. And in fact, the typical response time to a call to the police by a resident is 20 minutes. The typical amount of time to rape or murder or commit mayhem is 5 minutes or so. If you're unable to protect yourself, the police aren't going to be there in time to do it. Once again, those who are possessed or obsessed with gun control have missed the boat by a mile. Donald Trump observed that if the Paris citizens had been armed, there might have been a different outcome. And that is true across the board. Here's a very stunning article which actually has just blown away some of my colleagues with whom I've shared it. It doesn't seem plausible to us. Family of U.S. Muslim who killed 14 says they don't believe official account of the massacre and even suggests the Sandy Hook slaying didn't take place. Attorney David Chelsea is acting for the family of Saad Farouk, 28, and wife Tashfeen Malik, 27, killed 14 at holiday party in San Bernardino on Wednesday at Inland Regional Center, Cheslick. There were a lot of questions drawn with Sandy Hook and whether or not that was a real incident or not. In Sandy Hook shootings, 20 children and 6 teachers were killed by Adam Lanza, 20, in Newtown, Connecticut in December 2012. Chesley, it doesn't seem plausible to us that this petite woman, Malik, could be involved in this sort of hyper-caricatured Bonnie and Clyde crazy scenario. Now, let me say, I've looked into this attorney. He is very distinguished. He has an important law firm with at least 50 former judges and DAs and the like. He's a very formidable guy. I am reaching out to him because we can provide so much proof that the Sandy Hook event was a complete fraud, that the school was closed by 2008. There were no students there. Therefore, no students for Adam Lanza to have shot. Where even Paul Preston, a Los Angeles school safety expert, had reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education. He was so puzzled by what he was seeing, and all of them confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no children had died, and it was done to promote gun control. This book, 426 pages, proves it in spades, and I'm very glad to say we have the book back available again. I released the PDF to everyone worldwide for free when I discovered that Amazon was banning the book. It was obviously a political stunt, so I circumvented it by releasing the PDF for free. Well, the book can now be bought again in a bound edition by going to moonrockbooks.com. The PDF remains available, and the benefit of the PDF is that you get all the pictures and slides in color. You can examine them to your heart's content. Of necessity, when we published the book, we had to print the photographs in black and white, lest it become prohibitively expensive. So now you can have the best of both worlds. If you want to have a bound volume in addition to the PDF for free, you can obtain it at moonrockbooks.com. Now, I finish with one further slide, which is that Chris Matthews is slamming Donald Trump and telling their supporters, you should be ashamed. But this is ridiculous. Chris Matthews is the guy who ought to be ashamed. The latest information we have about the event in San Bernardino, by the way, is that the bodies of the alleged shooters were found in the back of a truck face down with their hands bound. Now, Chris Matthews, I wish you'd pull your head out from where the sun does not shine and catch up with the facts. We have published so much about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing. So much is coming out now about San Bernardino. Only someone practicing willful ignorance, refusing to look at the evidence, could continue to maintain a position such as that, which you make so public by virtue of your television program. Alan, I'm so pleased you're here because I know you have much more to add about particulars related to San Bernardino that confirm the thesis I am adumbrating here, to wit, that it was a staged event, and yet, ironically, it's going to have powerful negative repercussions for Obama and his efforts to control guns.
Yeah, I think this is probably the easiest mass shooting to debunk, this one. I did think it was Boston for a while, but I think this is the one. I think this is the one where the tide really turns. And I noticed you just said about them being in the car with their hands tied. I didn't know any of that, but that kind of fits in what I thought about the video footage that I saw of the car being hit by two large armored vehicles. If that's the case, the car was probably just radio controlled. And it was radio controlled by one of the vehicles, people in one of the vehicles. And then they just gently rammed it to make it look like there was some action going on. I didn't see anybody jump out. I didn't see any of that.
But not only that, Alan, no jumping out. I saw no blood around the vehicle. This is long after you have the vehicle.
Oh, no, I found some fake blood.
There are no bodies and not even any blood, fake or not.
Now, I've got some images that show fake bodies and fake blood. I've got some of those. And it's for the supposedly for the car that was hit by the two armored vehicles, but it seems to be in a different location. We will get round to that, Jim. Don't worry. So what's the camera guy do? Look at this police officer in this picture. She is absolutely terrified that somebody is taking a picture of her. And, of course, we got the classic giveaway here. Jim, you'll recognize this by now, surely.
The bottled water.
The bottled water, yep. Whenever there is one
of these. It's unbelievable. There were boxes of bottled water at Sandy Hook, of course, out in Oregon. They were carting around bottled water by the bushel basket. It was ridiculous, Alan.
And of course, it's not just
these AirSats first responders knew they were going to be on television. They put on the T-shirt for their cause of the week, which was breast cancer awareness. Yeah. They all put on their pink T-shirts knowing they'd be on television.
Yeah, they did, and all the pink T-shirts were immaculately clean as well, which was odd for a massacre and for people who are supposed to be dealing with bodies which have been shot. But this is one of the classic giveaways, this bunch of people just aimlessly wandering with the bottles and a very cautious-looking police officer. She looks far too small to be a police officer to me, Jim.
Yes, yes, I agree, Alan.
I don't think she is. Let's see the next picture. Standard stuff. Bunch of ladies weeping or looking like they're weeping, but not actually weeping. Nice big truck in the background for the police that's been set up so that, you know, every administrational aspect of this thing can be covered. It's all too organized. The next thing is that there's first responders, go to the next slide there. We've even got the probation department.
Mum was wondering, can you keep your voice down a bit?
I can try.
We can hear you downstairs.
No, okay, I'm on the radio.
I know.
Okay, the probation department. What's the probation department doing as a first responder?
I think that's a great question, Alan. And the ubiquitous bottled water present again.
Yeah, of course, of course. People are going to get thirsty when they're being shepherded around into different buses, on those buses, off those buses. But the probation department, do they usually turn up at mass shootings? I don't think so.
Was and one school of the buses on there
too, I think. Do school buses usually turn up at mass shootings? No, they don't. The next one. Now, we've seen all of this before, Jim, with these people who are unfamiliar with firearms. And we've got somebody here who seems to be pointing to a part of the long arm, and they look as if they're saying, okay, is this the one I mustn't touch? Or looks totally, totally out of place with a firearm. Totally out of place. And I've never seen any military or police officer pick up a long arm and do what that guy is doing on the left-hand side there. Perhaps he's playing shoot-em-up or something, but people who've got experience of firearms don't usually do that sort of thing. Now, the guy over to the left, to the right, sorry, if you look on his leg, he's got a nice big commando dagger there. He's ready for whatever's going to happen. They're making a big day of it here. It's their big day out.
And Roy observes that the man with the rifle doesn't have his finger, you know, inserted in relation to the trigger to make sure, of course, he doesn't do something stupid.
Well, he might not know where the trigger is, Jim. the next one. The lady's got brand new greens on. These have just come out of the packet. We can see that. They've been issued for the day. And the way she's got her firearm slung there, No, you don't do that. The reason you don't do that is because you're wearing a belt and it's got all kinds of gizmos on it, and it only takes one of those gizmos to knock up against either the safety or the trigger and you're done. You either shoot somebody else in the foot or you just surprise everybody.
Or dislodge the magazine.
Yeah, you don't carry firearms like that. The arm would be shoulder slung.
Roy's observing that as a U.S. Marine, he never carried a weapon in that position, and I agree with him completely.
I've never seen a weapon carried that like that by a trained soldier. The next one, please, Charles. Well, here we again. It's marvelous we have no tears here. We not only see no blood anywhere, but we see no real tears. But we do see lots of people poking their fingers in their eyes. And this lady in purple, she's quite famous for the day. We've got lots of other images of her in various places doing various things. I can't see a wound there.
They must have had a shortage of crisis actors to have one woman play so many roles.
Well, yes. And I think the wounded color for this drill was purple, by the way. Now, the next one.
This is a good one, Alan, because it's those men in blue vests that seem to be managing things. They have clipboards and seem to be keeping track of what's going on.
Yeah, and they obviously thought that all of the victims were going to be on fire. Look how many fire trucks there are. What are they doing responding to a shooting?
And none of them seem to be running. They're all just there as props.
Yeah, of course. Well, the poor firemen are actually being used as the second perimeter. The fire trucks constitute the second perimeter to obfuscate what's actually happening. Beyond the fire trucks, you're going to have a row probably of FEMA actors dressed up as coppers, as police officers. And beyond them, you might have one or two sheriff's deputies, who are being told that something is going on. And I don't know what's happening to the real firemen, but I don't think they're in amongst this lot. I think real firemen are just told, park your vehicle there, get out the way, there's some danger element. But why a fireman there? Any good reason for that, Jim?
Not of which I'm aware of.
Well,
no fires were reported to my knowledge.
Well, one of the things is that they're part of this FEMA fusion organization. There are MOUs, Memorandum of Understanding, between fire departments, even now refuse departments, to correspond with these FEMA operations. Now, the next one. Now, could we bring our expert in here to tell us if this person's arms would actually be under the straps or?
Roy, ought they not, ought not this, this victim's arm be properly strapped in?
We generally don't strap their arms underneath, because what would happen is eventually that would give free movement to the torso, which is what we're trying to secure here. As far as the fire department being there, generally when you have a quote MCI, the fire department is on the box assignment plane for that, and they will come out and support the EMS response by filling in certain logistical roles. For instance, that may be a firefighter paramedic who's dual trained, who may be in charge of the treatment, triage, or transport sectors and so forth. As far as this goes, what I do notice is the railings to prevent the patient from rolling off of the ambulance cot are not up. There's improper cervical immobilization done on this patient. If this is a true trauma patient, which I'll talk about in the next segment, generally what we will do is we will strip every stitch of clothing off of them. And the reason we do that is not because we're a bunch of perverts. It's just if someone has a occult wound that we fail to recognize, see, and manage, that could contribute to increased mortality and morbidity. So if this patient is being treated as a trauma patient, she would be naked. Every stitch of clothing would come off of her, because we need to properly assess our patients to be able to care for them. So there are a lot of things in here that look like they're trying to show the unschooled individual that this is an organic emergency response. And to me, I don't know if I'm buying it yet. I'm kind of on the fence right now, but there's a lot of things that I'm seeing here that are just saying, wait a minute, I wouldn't do that. And I've been a paramedic almost 30 years.
Right. Let's just go back to the other shot with all the fire engines there. Roy, why are there no ambulances there?
Well, depending on, and again, this is kind of a snippet. I don't know what this area is supposed to be. Is this supposed to be a triage area? Is it a transport area? Is it a casualty collection point? I really can't get a bead on what this is supposed to be. The fire apparatus would generally be staged away because we're most likely not going to need fire hoses and so forth. But is from the other side of the shot, is there a collection of ambulances waiting for these people? I don't know. I really can't get a bead as a professional of what this picture is supposed to depict for me. Now, if I was John Q. Public, I might be looking at this and saying, wow, boy, they really have their response in order out there is they have the fire department assisting EMS and so forth and so on. So I don't know what this is supposed to be because the fire apparatus are not going to be needed. And if the camera would pan, maybe do a 360, we may see a group of ambulances waiting for patients to be taken away. But as far as the fire department's response to a mass casualty incident, like you said, there are memorandum of understanding, and that is not an unusual sight to see. But I would expect to see a few more people that are actual patient care providers. And here they're just kind of mulling around.
Roy, if you're saying that there are ambulances up, say, I don't know, perhaps to the left or right, where are the teams from the ambulances? And would they be treating the people instead of the fire officers?
No, that's what Roy implied. That's what Roy implied, Alan. He said he doesn't see those who are actually providing the emergency care present. A lot of firemen, that's not their role. And you have some tarps down, but it all looks kind of jumbled to me, like they're trying to create an impression of chaos, but it's not really warranted by the circumstances.
No, yeah. we do a lot of training on scenarios like this. So, and as we'll see later on in the program, we do a lot of interagency training so that when we have an organic event, we know exactly who's doing what, when they're doing it, and where they're doing it at. This looks like these folks have never trained for this scenario, not one time. They look almost confused. They don't know which way they're going here. I don't see any patients, and I don't see any paramedics providing real patient care. That picture of a woman on a stretcher, I don't know what that's supposed to be. That could
go
have been.
Go back to eight. Yeah. Let's go to the next one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that picture there, I don't know what that's supposed to be.
But, look, Ray, if they're on a gurney, surely you get the ambulances in as close as you can to the gurney, do you not? I mean, you don't run them half a mile on the gurney.
No, but what we do take into consideration when we're actually staging the apparatus is we don't want the ambulance too close to, say, the forward treatment area or the triage area because of the exhaust. And we need an area where we can put that apparatus where they're going to have appropriate ingress and egress from the scene. So generally what would happen, even in training scenarios, is those units that are going to be used to transport patients to the hospital are going to be staged away, but not so far away that you have to run a quarter mile with someone on an ambulance cot. So they're going to be close enough not to interfere with increasing noise and exhaust and so forth into areas where you're trying to treat patients. But they're certainly not going to be so far away that you have to run a half a PFT course to get to them. And again, this woman on this cot, if she was a true trauma patient, which is I think what they're trying to depict. First of all, her clothing would be cut off. She would be covered by a sheet. The rails on the stretcher would be up, which are required as for patient safety. And, this fella here, this paramedic or whatever firefighter, whatever he's supposed to be there in the road guard vest, he's just kind of strolling along, with no sense of urgency. And what I can see from this also is this does not appear to be a patient under a paramedic's care, because a patient that would be under a paramedic's care would have a cardiac monitor applied to them. They would have intravenous access applied to them. This just looks like someone that they picked up over maybe off of the green tarp or the yellow tarp and said, okay, put this person in your ambulance and take them to the quote unquote hospital.
Roy, Alan and I are both delighted you're here, Roy, to add your level of expertise to our preliminary analyses. This is something I've done professionally my whole career, bringing in experts in different areas to complement areas where I was unqualified to render judgments. We're just absolutely delighted you're here, Roy. Let's look at the next photograph, too, and you and Alan can both comment on it as well.
Roy, we've got about, I don't know, perhaps 9 people there around the one. Well, so I'm presuming that there's somebody in the middle of that being treated. Would that really be how things work? Surely you just have 2 or 3 medics in there doing the stuff and the other people looking for something else to do, wouldn't you?
It looks phony. It looks staged. I don't think there's anything that looks very artificial.
I think what they're trying to do here is place someone on a long spine board. In the foreground there, just slightly from midline off to our right side, you'll see a package there. It looks like a portable television. That's a cardiac monitor. In the background there, it looks like a backpack just to the left of the fellow with the blue vest on. That looks like some type of treatment bag. And to the far left, we see what is supposed to be a paramedic with exam gloves on and a woman sitting there on a telephone. If this were a treatment area, it would probably take at most 3 people to place this person in spinal immobilization, if that was even required to be done. It looks like we have a lot of folks kind of just standing around watching what the medics are doing. Many times firefighters who are not medically trained are very eager to assist us, but go to great lengths to stand back and allow us to work, but be close enough in earshot if we were to need something. If this were an organized treatment area, each person would have an assignment. You're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this. If you're not doing anything, what happens is we have an area called a manpower pool. And folks that do not have an assignment, whether it be on the fire ground, an MCI, or whatever the case is, are sent to a manpower pool in case they're needed for a couple reasons. Number one, too many cooks spoil the sauce. So we want to make sure that we have adequate manpower to do what we need to do, but we don't want freelancing. The second is we need to maintain accountability for all rescuers, all emergency services personnel on the scene. If we just allow people to wander around and hang out and watch what's going on, eventually we lose accountability for them. When we lose accountability, we end up losing members of the service, and that's a problem. So this, again, there's no real sense of urgency. This looks more like a training scenario to me. That's my, just looking at it real quick, it looks like something I would see in a training manual.
I'd go one on from that and say that these guys are here to actually shield whatever's going on, because there's not actually a real emergency in there.
That's possible. In today's litigatory society, we go to great lengths to protect privacy. Privacy of the patient is governed by certain federal and state laws. So we do try to protect the identities of patients. So we may have firefighters stand in front of them so the press aren't taking photographs of them, so forth and so on. But this fellow there in the front with the baseball cap on, standing next to just to the left of the fellow, looks like his name is Conwell or Cornwell. He just seems like he's looking on to see what they're doing. Now, if this were a training scenario, maybe he's some manner of evaluator. I don't know. But again, just from the first look at this, it looks like a training scenario.
But your point about the press here, Roy, the press actually aren't allowed in here. So, I mean, this isn't from the press. This would be taken by a FEMA operative who would take this passable photograph. They're not going to let anything, well, this is my view, they're not going to let anything get out that shows that this thing is faked up.
Yeah, we do have photographers, department approved photographers, who go through training to know what they can and cannot photograph. anytime that we're doing a training scenario, at the end of that training scenario, much as we did in the Marine Corps, we would have a debrief and a hot wash where we would review it. And just like a football coach would, we will show videos, we will show photographs of the training scenario so that we can get a better handle on what went well and what do we need, where do we need to improve. So that's what this photograph could be. It could be, let's make sure that we have photographic documentation of what we're doing here. And just to kind of to push the narrative where at Sandy Hook, we saw no medical treatment of anybody at any time, less one woman with some type of ankle injury was the only person that we saw. Where
the one lady on the gurney.
If this were some manner of training scenario, they may want to show. Or if this was a contrived event, they may want to show that, yes, there were patients. Yes, we did do things. So this isn't a Sandy Hook. This is a real organic event.
There's another point there that the lady that we actually saw going into the back of the ambulance on the gurney, she must have been pushed all the way from the school up to the firehouse then.
From my look at that, it looks like she had been brought up to the back of the firehouse, where in some photographs you can see from the aerial photography done by the news helicopter, there was an area with red tarps and a group of chairs, which to me was reminiscent of a rehabilitation area where first responders would go to be medically cleared to go back to duty at the incident. So I don't know how she made it there, but it appears that she was put on a cot. Ambulance cot and pushed by one either EMT or paramedic over to a waiting ambulance and loaded and taken away. Now this woman that we can see in this.
No, sorry, go on, Roy.
In this photograph that we're looking at, this woman here in the purple top that appears to be speaking on a cell phone, she was also the one that was shown with her hands a few slides earlier being loaded up into the ambulance with her hands over her face in some type of look of anguish. Well,
yeah, we're not finished with her yet, right?
That's good because I'm guessing she's got a pretty interesting story because she's sitting there looking just well and about as comfortable as could be. Maybe she's ordering lunch. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, would you put her on an ambulance cart, do you think?
If I had one available, in the pre-planned response that we set up for MCIs, there are times where we will utilize buses for what we call walking wounded. They're green tags. They don't have life-threatening injuries. Maybe they just want to go to the hospital to, quote, be checked out and then discharged from the ER. I don't know if I would have put her on a cot. I may have just sat her in an ambulance and driven her over. I may have put her on a bus with the 15 or 20 other, quote, walking wounded that we have. And, okay, they're going to go over to such and such a hospital for evaluation. I don't think I would have put her on a cot. She doesn't need it.
Okay. Next slide, please, Chance. So where's the crime?
She's a crime scene investigator, but where's the crime scene?
And she's got the brand new greens on as well. They must have issued them for the day. Next one.
Yeah, she doesn't even have a belt on. Where's she going to carry her weapon?
Now, this one is a bit confused because this was put out as being from the San Bernardino incident. But it was actually, I think, from some kind of a shooting in a club. But if somebody's trying to sell it off as the San Bernardino incident, we've got this woman in the middle there in red. I think she's got probably her son or daughter on the side there who's trying to hide their face at the fact they're laughing at this lady and her whatever she's trying to do. But I'm not sure where this came from now because I've seen it bylined as both a club shooting and San Bernardino, so I can't vouch for this photograph. Next one. I can vouch for this one, though, and this is a supreme piece of nonsense. We've got two men here who, by the positioning of their sidearms are obviously right-handed, using their long arms left-handedly. You don't do that. And if you did do that, it would be extremely odd to have two people who coincidentally were doing it at the same time. Again, this thing about playing around with the weapon, we've got the guy looking through the scope there and pointing it probably at the mirror, I think, to see what he looks like. And the other guy just looks so incompetent with that weapon. It looks like something out of the Three Stooges. It just doesn't look real. It looks like two actors have been given a load of stuff and nobody's told them what to do with it. What do you think, Jim, as a military man?
Oh, yeah, this is just ridiculous. And he doesn't even have his vest on properly. Notice how it's hanging loose. This is very amateurish. I agree completely. Let's try the next.
And there she is again. She's breaking news. She'll probably get home before six tonight. Is this the best they can do as a victim of the, what do we have, 14 dead? God knows how many wounded, 21 wounded, I think.
But the I think they're soliciting participants through ads and Craigslist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the caliber you're going to get, fat ladies in purple. Next shot. And we've got no ambulances, so let's just throw her in the back of the truck. Now, she's got a tourniquet on her leg there, so I don't know what injury she's got, but there doesn't seem to be any blood anywhere present. Nobody actually seems to be taking any notice of her in the back of the truck there. Roy, is that a common thing that you do? You just throw people in the back of a truck if you haven't got an ambulance there? You're laughing, Roy. Take me seriously.
I'm trying to. If I had no other means to egress a patient out to a casualty collection point and I had a pickup truck available, yeah, you know what? I might throw a couple people in there and say, okay, let's divvy out. Let's get out of here and get to the casualty collection point if I had no other recourse. So, yeah, you know what? I might do that. These actions are situation dependent. Yeah. But I'll tell you this much. If I were the boss and as a director, I would be going up to one of my paramedics and saying, please tell me that you did not have an ambulance available and you had to resort to using a pickup truck to get these folks out. And if that were the case, fine. Generally, having worked in urban EMS most of my career, I've seen plenty of gunshot wounds. They bleed a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't know where the wound is. And if this is something that is contrived, maybe they should have used a black pickup truck because red blood on white paint would show up pretty easily.
Well, I'm going to go one step ahead of you there, Roy. What I would have said was, hey, look, I've got all these fire trucks everywhere. They've got lots of sirens and bells on them and they go fast. Let's put a few people on the seats in there and take them to the hospital. Rather than using a pickup truck, because then I shift over my liability to somebody else's insurance company. I'm going to presume that there are insurance liabilities for this sort of thing and that ambulance drivers try to stay away from this kind of thing here, sticking people in the back of trucks. But anyway, next picture. I still haven't seen any blood yet anywhere. So I'm a bit, you know, these are supposed to be shotgun wounds or rather gunshot wounds. I'm kind of expecting to see some blood on this tarp there somewhere, Roy. Am I being a bit overambitious in doing that?
No, I don't think so. Again, looking at this, and this is the first time I've seen this photograph. This looks like it's supposed to be a treatment area, I would guess. I could see the woman who's lying on her back there in that supine position may have some dressing maybe up on her thigh or something along those lines and maybe around her knee. But again, I'm not seeing anything that looks like gunshot wounds. I'm not seeing, in fact, I don't even see anything that looks like moulage for a gunshot wound. So unless these were lower priority patients, I mean, generally, if someone has an overt gunshot wound, most of the time, especially if it's multiple gunshot wounds, you can see them and an experienced EMS provider will say, you're a red patient, you're priority one, we need to get you to a trauma center. These folks here, are they yellow priority? Are they a lower priority? Where are their wounds at? And other than rolling some folks on the ground, I see one very tiny little medical kit, but I maybe two, but I don't see any real treatment going on. I see a fella there in the upper right-hand corner wearing a vest. He may be the treatment area coordinator who's responsible for that casualty collection point. But yeah. I'm not seeing a whole lot of treatment going on.
That's
here.
That's the guy with the clipboard again, you're talking about there, Roy. The guy with the clipboard?
Right, yep. Yeah. Right, with the blue upper vest and the yellow jacket.
Upper right-hand
so
corner.
So he may be, that's the one. He may be part of the incident command team that's there managing this. But, what is this trying to show us? I see minimal, maybe some basic first aid going on. I see a woman there. I'm guessing she's a paramedic getting ready to assess or begin treatment of a patient. And I see a fellow being helped over to that treatment area, to that casualty collection point. So again, I still haven't seen of all of these patients true life-threatening wounds that I can see. And I haven't seen any true care being provided. Where are the cardiac monitors that would be applied? Where is the intravenous solutions that we would consider having IV access on a multi trauma patient, which in the next segment I'll talk about a little bit deeper. Yeah. But again, I don't see a whole lot of treatment going on here. I don't know. Again, I'm first time seeing this photo. I'm still kind of dumbfounded as to what it's supposed to depict to me.
Roy, look, just treat me as the comedy relief for the moment. But wouldn't there be pressure bandages here for gunshot wounds?
Well, gunshot wounds on an extremity are treated with not only pressure bandages, but if there's a chance of exsanguination or bleeding out, tourniquets are applied. They are back in fashion now. There are what we call hemostatic agents that may be applied to help control or stop bleeding. Generally, in a trauma scenario, we talk about something called the golden hour. And the golden hour is the first 60 minutes after the injury is occurred. Those patients with the greatest chance of survival reach definitive care, i.e. a level one or level two trauma center within 60 minutes of the injury. Generally, the triage and treatment that is provided in the field is provided with an eye on getting this person into a trauma center, and we minimize as best as possible any delays in transporting patients that are true trauma patients. So I'm talking about patients under the START triage system that would be tagged red or borderline between red and yellow. They have the highest priority. We don't mess around with them in the field, because trauma is a surgical disease. They need to be in a trauma center. And again, these look, if they are wounds, they look to be very minor. And from what I can see just in this photograph, I don't see anything that's life-threatening.
That guy in the yellow suit there in the front of the picture, Roy, would that be okay standing astride a patient like that?
We try to avoid it, but sometimes we have to. Depending on what procedure, he may be applying a tourniquet or a pressure dressing to a wound on that person's leg. Inadvertently, in the heat of the moment, I might straddle a patient if I need to. I try to avoid it, because if you look at his posture, if for some reason you do something that hurts on that patient's right leg, their left leg is in a wonderful position to let you know about it. So I try not to do that, but sometimes we don't have a choice.
Well, let's go to the next picture. Now we start getting into some of the nitty gritty, as you call it. Wow, look at this, real action. No, it's not. See that blood by the car there, Roy? That's not a bleed out, is it?
You mean the red spot is what you want to say?
Yeah, it's supposed to be blood. Let's just call it the red spot by the car. Roy, I've lost more than that shaving myself, Roy.
Yeah, the average adult male has about 6 liters of circulating blood volume, just to give you a little bit of perspective. That amount of blood, if that's what it is, if that's blood, I wouldn't shake a stick at it because, you know, like you said, I too have lost more blood than that shaving my face. I've skinned my knee and lost more blood. So that little bit of blood would not be of great concern to me.
Now,
the photo doesn't give me enough detail to say, you know, is that blood? I know that's what the picture is trying to project to us, that, oh, here's the blood-stained macadam where this person was, but that's not enough blood for me to even consider. If that's the only blood loss that I could find, and all my patient, I didn't see any bruising or something telling me that they're hemorrhaging internally, that amount of blood would not even qualify for entry into a trauma center. If I brought somebody in that lost that maybe 100 cc, 150 cc's of blood and called a trauma alert for that, the trauma surgeon would laugh at me as he took my badge off my shirt.
Why does the body look so artificial to me, Roy?
It's a dummy, that's why.
That is one explanation. As we lose blood volume, the pallor of our skin begins to change. So people who have exanguated, lost their circulating volume of blood can have an appearance of being kind of waxy or yellow or almost like they have artificial rubber skin. Now, I have friends that I know, colleagues that I work with, that specialize in moulage and what we call simulades, dummies, if you will, that are used in training scenarios that could do everything from talk to you to bleed on you. So could that be a training aid? That's possible. The moulage of today, the special effects of today are outstanding. Could that be a real person? Again, if that's the only amount of blood that they lost next to that tire, there's no reason that that person should die from that amount of blood loss. If that's a real person, I don't know.
Roy, if they'd lost that amount of blood at that position, why is there no trail of blood to where they finally died?
Well, were they bleeding? Were they still alive when they were moved to that position? If the heart had stopped bleeding, then there would be no trail of blood because there's no longer any circulating volume. Did they bleed out in the back of that car and that just happened to be a puddle that got pushed out? If their heart was still beating, then what would have happened is there would be a trail of blood. So,
okay.
I don't know.
But you don't see any blood actually on the dummy or person that's on the ground.
Maybe a little bit right there in the center of that body. Maybe that's some type of wound. But again, the picture's not close enough to say, hey, they got 2 liters of blood in their clothing.
Yeah.
Alan, we got a lot of slides.
Yep. Okay. Now, Roy, do you notice that you don't see any striped line laying in the same direction as the dummy in that road?
No. No, I see a white stripe. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, but that's not going in the same direction as the dummy, is it?
No.
In fact, it's going in the opposite direction. Let's look at the next picture. So where did the line go? Where did the broken stripe go?
It'd be trick photography because I don't see it.
Well, I'm saying we're looking at two different scenes.
That very well could be. I mean, this is a head-on picture of the front of the vehicle. The other one was a side picture, but it certainly looks different to me.
In the other picture we had, the stuff was quite some distance from the back wheel, and this stuff seems to be actually in the shadow of the back of the car. I'm saying this is a different location. Next picture. This again is one of those people who probably hasn't handled an AR-15 before and has decided to stroke around the trigger a bit because he likes the firearm. Jim?
Yeah.
You ever carried one like that?
It's ridiculous, Alan. You're completely right. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Someone who doesn't have any experience handling firearms.
Yeah. Next picture. Now, yeah, this lot is going quiet as a sheep. One thing that we forgot to mention when we looked at that Oregon shooting, Jim, is that all the people were being searched. This is a very good way of rounding up revenue for people who've got dope in their bags, illegal anything, this, that, and the other. You do a search because you think they might have a weapon. You find some dope. Wow, bingo, revenue. I don't like this. I don't know where the law comes from that you can do this to people. If they go in to pick up a shooter and I'm not that shooter, I'm sorry, I'm going where I want to go. Unless it's into an area of danger that interferes with these people, I'm not going to be herded like a sheep like this. You can forget that. And if I'm American, I think I've got rights to say, no, I'm sorry, you show me some cause why you should detain me. But I am not going to be herded like this ever in my life. I can tell you that. Next picture. Here's your Roy. You can tell us something about these people again. Here they are. They're sort of just casually taking the non-wounded victim somewhere again.
I would like to know where their suspicion of spinal trauma came from, because generally we do not package patients like this on a longboard with a cervical immobilization device and straps unless we suspect some manner of spinal injury. In fact, the American College of Surgeons has come out with a position paper saying that we should place less people on backboards like this because of the fact that as they lay down, it applies pressure to certain nerve plexus and can actually mimic pain of an injury that isn't there. So what is leading the paramedics to believe that this woman or person or whoever that is in some manner injured their spine that requires full immobilization like that? I don't understand it. We don't even immobilize patients with gunshot wounds to the thoracic cavity like this anymore just for that purpose. So I don't understand why they even did that. It looks to me like it's being done for show. This is a picture that I would expect to see in an EMT basic book.
Okay. Next picture. Now, would you allow, Roy, you wouldn't allow anybody to carry anything while they were on one of these trolleys, would you?
The patient or the... Yeah, generally, I don't let my patients talk on the cell phone when they're on a backboard or yeah. I may, if they're a woman, I may set their purse or briefcase, if it's something light, maybe between their legs so that they can see their personal effects. But, yeah, usually not. And as you can see with this fella, they've cut his shirt off. So they, for some reason, they're suspecting that he has some type of trauma. If this patient has a penetrating trauma to the thoracic cavity, that is automatically an advanced life support call, would not be treated by EMTs, would be treated by paramedics. So yeah. I don't know. Did this person say he had chest pain and they opened their shirt to do a 12-lead EKG on them? I don't know. Again, there doesn't look like there's a lot of care. And this is not to detract from my brother paramedics that work for AMR, American Medical Response, that have the contract to provide emergency medical services for that area. I know some of the folks that work out there. They're very, very competent providers, and they are consummate professionals.
Alan, so you have about eight minutes for the rest of your slides.
How many minutes, Jim?
Eight.
Okay, let's go to the next slide, and we can see that the guy has actually got a sachet of fake blood there in his hand. If indeed he's even a human being, he looks like he could be a dummy, but I'm not sure either way on that one. Next slide. It's a woman in purple again. She's getting a really good photo opportunity. Next slide.
I love your caption, Alan. Don't worry, honey, I'm sure we'll find some more bottled water.
Now, these guys just strike me, as you say, Roy, with their casual sort of atmosphere. Of the thing. I can't take this seriously. Next slide. Now, I think I've worked out what they do. This lady may be a genuine sheriff. I don't know from the way that she's got the weapon slung. But beyond her is what I call the blanket. It's the blanket of people who may be dressed up as police officers, and they're there just to simply keep the view obfuscated so that nobody can see in. And they may have all been shipped there in the buses that you can see, the yellow buses, which again is obfuscation. It's a barrier to seeing.
Look at all those supposed cops there just sort of in a mass. I mean, they don't appear to be there for any purposeful activity.
Yeah, they look like they're from Rent-A-Crowd, don't they? Miss the next slide and go on to 27 there. Now, I think we've seen this guy before, Jim. We caught him as the father of one of the dead at Sandy Hook and also as a sniper at Sandy Hook. It looks very much like him. Next one. Lots of emotion on the face, but no tears, of course, again. But there's a photographer there to capture it, of course, but not a normal press photographer. The FEMA photographer. Next one.
Alan, I'm missing your voice.
You're missing. You got me now?
Talk. I couldn't hear you there.
Okay. No, I was just looking at this next one. And here again, we've got the another person that they're thinking of putting into the truck, probably. And there's still no ambulances there. But lucky they got the MRAP behind it. Perhaps they should take her in that. Who knows? Next picture. And this is the only blood that, or it may be blood, I don't know. It looks like tomato sauce to me, that I've seen.
It doesn't look like blood to me. Does it look like blood to you, Roy?
Not really. I've had a lot of people bleed on my uniform before, and where did that blood come from? First of all, if I saw someone with blood on the outside of their clothing, I would immediately be saying, I need to take a look at you because I need to know, is that your blood or is that someone else's blood? And furthermore, that shirt, now I'm not a law enforcement officer, but I would think that shirt is now evidence, because if that is blood from one of the quote victims, where did he get it from? Where was he when he got it? Was he in the room? Is there splatter pattern on that? That should be logged as evidence, if you ask me.
Roy, we're at the end of Alan's slide set. It seems to me what we're witnessing here is a very slovenly acted performance, very poorly done.
Yeah, I wasn't exactly sold that this was an organic event from the beginning, but as we've gone through, and some of the points that Alan has brought up to me is really starting to tilt my scale.
Excellent, excellent. Roy, now we're going to turn to your comments about Sandy Hook Elementary School. And I love you begin with this quote from an air traffic controller on 9/11. Is this real world or exercise?
I couldn't resist that when as I was writing the slide program, it kind of hit me. I remember hearing that recording, that air traffic controller saying, well, is this real world or is this exercise? And I was like, well, that seems to be appropriate.
So if we could
move to the next slide. This is just a little bit of my career overview here. I entered the fire service in 1988. I was assigned to an engine company with promotion to rescue company captain, which is a pretty big deal because a rescue company is a very autonomous unit. I was a captain, ended acting battalion chief in a fire department, entered emergency medical service basic training in 1992, completed mobile intensive care paramedic in 1997. So that's been a very long time. I've been chief paramedic and MICU shift commander, as you can see there. I've served in many EMS models, including municipal, hospital-based, private sector. So I've been around for a while. Currently, I work as a director of operations and clinical services for an emergency medical service department. I also teach. So I teach the pre-hospital trauma life support, advanced cardiac life support, pediatric advanced life support, just about the whole alphabet courses that you could come up with. I also teach the Staff and Command program. So that's kind of that's a program that all company and senior staff officers must attend to be able to take command of a scene. If we could go to the next slide, please. And again, you know, I've held both staff and teaching positions at level one trauma centers. The difference between a level one and a level two trauma center, level one trauma centers are teaching facilities, which means that they are attached to a college or university, have residency and internship programs. So I'm also a United States Marine. I served with the 24th and the 22nd MUSOC. My entire career, I held an infantry MOS, an 0300 MOS, was a staff non-commissioned officer. So I've been around just a little bit. If we could go to the next slide, please. Although a PowerPoint master, I am not. So let's talk about what is a mass casualty incident and what constitutes it. And when we kind of boil it down, when your number of victims outnumbers your number of resources. So a resource could be a basic life support ambulance, an advanced life support ambulance, an engine company. So anytime that you have a situation, for instance, my partner and I go to a car accident. He's an EMT basic. I'm a paramedic. We have four patients. Technically, that constitutes an MCI until we call for additional resources. So large MCIs, what we do is we pre-plan for these. We get together at the local, at the department, local, state, county, and federal level and pre-plan for large incidents. There are entire college courses on large incident planning, and there's also college level courses on how to plan a drill. So as we can see from the Art of War, no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. So no matter how good our pre-planning is, because these incidents are very dynamic, they don't, the pre-plan gives us a good rubric and a good pattern to try to follow, but it's not a guarantee. So a lot of these courses you can find on FEMA.gov. A lot of them are correspondence courses that are self-directed study. So anybody can kind of sit in one of these courses and take that class. Next slide, please. So an organic response, any emergency that comes about where someone would contact 911, we call that an organic response. It's not scripted. It's not a drill. So generally, when you call 911, the operator picks up the phone, says, 911, where is your emergency? I don't even care what your emergency is. Where is it at? Because I can get someone started. Police department, fire department, EMS, somebody is on the way. So that is what's called a PSAP, or Public Service Answering Point. These are all regulated by the Federal Communications Commission and the Telecommunications Act. So the next one is a PSDP, which is a Public Service Dispatch Point. And that is the actual person who hits the button in the encoder to dispatch the unit. So the call takers are at PSAPs, dispatchers are at PSDPs. They're generally under the same roof, maybe separated by a partition wall or something like that. So understand that the national average response time for an advanced life support unit in the United States is between 6 and 7 minutes, much better than the police departments, which are average about 20 minutes. So when you hit 911 and say, I'm at 123 Main Street and I have chest pain, I need an ambulance, we're going to start getting some information. We're going to give you what we call pre-arrival instructions, and you are going to be sent on your way, or your ambulance is going to be sent on their way to come and help you. So it's kind of important to understand the difference between an organic response and a scripted response. Next slide.
Well, can I ask a question, please? You're always going to get there before the cop.
In many places, yeah.
Yeah.
The cops again, it depends. Donut and coffee, Alan.
Yeah.
We have the paramedics have a very, very good working relationship with the police. And what I tell my students in the paramedic class is this. When a firefighter gets burned, they don't care where the next engine company is coming from. Where are the paramedics? That's what the battalion chief says. When a police officer gets shot, the patrol sergeant doesn't care where the next squad car is coming from. Where are the paramedics? When I look at Sandy Hook, the question that boggles my mind is, where are the paramedics? Not even the EMTs. The difference between an EMT and a paramedic is the difference between a meter maid and an FBI agent. Paramedics are highly educated, highly trained individuals. And we generally, we're very good at interviewing people, and we are also very good at observation. And I think this is, could be a contributing reason as to why they did not want paramedics inside that school. So here we have a training response. A training response is scripted. It is pre-planned. They're used to test various components of the emergency response system. Now, this could be at a department level, a department drill. It could be a municipal drill, county drill, state drill, or a capstone event, which I've been involved in. So these could go from very small to very large. They also have in the writing of the drill, they will have a safe word, because the last thing that we want is a organic event to happen and someone to call 911 to report an incident, and that dispatcher in that PSDP needs to have a word to relay to the units in the field that this is an organic event. We are no longer on a training script. So there is something that we, a term we will use, like a safe word. They'll hit the alert tone, which gives a very long beep, and the dispatcher may say something like, this is real world, this is not a drill, and they'll hit the alert out. So this way, we don't have the confusion that we supposedly had on 9/11, because if we can obfuscate the difference between a real world event and a scripted training event, we can hide things inside of that. And as planners, we don't want that. I don't want to deny somebody an ambulance because a dispatcher thought it was part of a training evolution when this was for real Mrs. Smith at 123 Main Street having chest pain and a heart attack, and she didn't get an ambulance because a dispatcher didn't know what was real and what was fake. So next slide, please. So what's the incident command system? The incident command system is the system that we use so that we can have coordinated mitigation of an incident. It's a universal structure that is dynamic. So as the incident evolves, the command structure will evolve along with it. And since 9/11, since FEMA has pushed the NIMS system, the National Emergency Management System, every police officer, EMT, paramedic, firefighter, whether a career or volunteer, every trash man, postal worker, has to take certain parts of the NIMS so that you know from Homeland Security where you live in their command structure. So the so once FEMA and Homeland Security instituted the NIMS, that was the training modules to let us know that if you have an incident, this is how you must mitigate it.
Now,
so
boy, of course,
the incident command, yes.
If you're trying to conduct a drill or a fake event and make it look as though it were real, then you're going to want to obfuscate just those very features that would ordinarily differentiate between them.
Yes, and with the National Incident Management System that's been instituted since September 11th, the ability to obfuscate using that NIM system becomes much easier because it can be very compartmentalized, as we'll see in some slides as we go. So when law enforcement is running an event, they want it to be a law enforcement only event, and they use EMS and the fire service only as much as they feel that they need to. So when we talk about the incident command system, that's what we're talking about. So next slide, please. And I'm just trying to get everybody on term with some lingo here. So as I'm speaking, or like, what's this guy talking about? So what is unified command? In the National Incident Response Plan and the National Incident Management System, we have something called unified command. That is where a command post is established, and I'm going over this in very broad strokes, and all representatives of stakeholder organizations are there. So you have a commander from the police department. You may have the fire chief, the chief paramedic, and a representative of municipal services, the water department, or whatever the incident calls for. Those people are in the command post at all times. So if this is a fire and we have a large warehouse burning, the fire chief is the overall incident commander. However, law enforcement and emergency medical services are always represented in the command post, always, under this unified command. This is the requirement that has been set out by not just FEMA and Homeland Security, but also the NFPA, the National Firefighters Protection Agency, and the National Department of Transportation, which runs EMS throughout the nation. They are the overriding body. So this unified command structure needs to be followed. When you deviate from either the ICS program or this unified command, if you're going to apply for federal monies to be reimbursed later on, you need to tell the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA why you deviated from their program. And you better have a good reason or you're not getting any money back. They're not going to reimburse your calls. Next slide, please.
And Roy, the rationale here is to have absolutely uniform procedures for response across the country, every city, every state, across the country.
Yes, unified training, unified vocabulary, so that, again, if I when I was in New York City at 9/11, we had units come from Los Angeles County that were there, and we need to have common language.
But I'm just saying that, you know, before FEMA, 9/11, and all this nonsense, communities responded perfectly well with their own procedures without having a uniform vocabulary or a command structure dictated from the top.
Absolutely. We were able to mitigate emergencies with, and again, there would be some variances in what constituted what, and I'll just give a for instance, an engine company in the fire department has a very specific definition where an engine company without common terms, an engine company in Mississippi could be different than an engine company in Montana. So they tried to bring that all under some unified system, but for most incidents, for instance, something like at Sandy Hook, that should have been a local incident. Why did the federal government need to be there? They didn't. That was a local law enforcement, local EMS, and local fire department jurisdiction. They made it a federal incident. So,
and of course,
why did they do that?
Well, we know why they did.
The federal government
is just. I'm the comedy relief here. Why did they do that then, Roy?
The federal government has very deep pockets. And when we talk about large protracted incidents, it's going to run into the millions of dollars just to compensate people for overtime. So the local government may not have pockets deep enough to support that. So they may request a limited state of emergency be declared by the state, for instance, which gives them the municipalities access to federal monies for reimbursement. It also brings in for investigation, it brings in the auspice and authorities of the FBI, ATF, Homeland Security. So sometimes it's almost like it's easier to bump it upstairs to your boss, to your big brother, and let him bear not only the cost, but also the resources needed. So for large incidents like that, many times, even without the public knowing it, it goes under the auspices of FEMA.
Now, did you find it surprising that no bodies were placed on the triage tarps that were at Sandy Hook? Of course, the ground temperature was 28 degrees Fahrenheit. A case could be,
right. You
know, rationale for leaving the bodies inside, which is on its face absurd. I contend it is absurd. They should have been rushed in ambulances to hospitals where doctors could pronounce them dead or alive. It could be said, well, they were a convenient refrigeration unit. In fact, Alan and I have discussed there's no heat rising an unheated building. So, you know, was not in service. I mean, there's so many signs that this was a fraud, but I'm interested in what you thought about, you know, the general response with no surge of medical technicians and no medevac helicopter, no string of ambulances and the like.
I think we may have that in the next slide. We can skip this one. Yeah. First of all, when it comes to treating trauma patients, pediatrics, next slide, please. Pediatrics and adults are treated very differently. Okay. So again, the goal of trauma is to get them off scene en route to a hospital in 10 minutes. Now, It is a documented fact, and there's a slide to show this later on. It is a documented fact that for every one complete drop in body temperature below 95 degrees Fahrenheit, mortality and morbidity increases by up to 10%. If I were treating trauma cases, the last thing I would want to do is set them out on a tarp in an open parking lot when it's 20-some degrees. Because as we discussed earlier in the program, trauma patients need to be what we call trauma naked. We need to cut their clothes off. We need to make sure that we can find every single wound. And if we cut all their clothes off and we set them out in the middle of a parking lot, their body core temperature is going to drop down. They're going to die of hypothermia. So the use of air medical, as a field supervisor, as a chief paramedic in the field, if I were dispatched to that, one of the first things that I would ask is, number one, do I have the availability of air medical, and what is their ETA, flight time ETA to my scene? Number two, what is the bed status of the local hospitals, including the trauma centers? Because I'm going somewhere where I could have the potential of 20 or 30 patients. I can't send 30 patients to one hospital. It would overwhelm them. I need to split them up. If the dispatcher comes back and says air medical is available with a 10-minute flight time, you know what? Fly them. I will find a place to land them. That's where the fire department comes in. Hey, fire chief, I got 3 medevac helicopters on their way. Their ETA is 10 minutes. I need 3 landing zones. The fire department will set them up.
Stop you there, Roy. Roy, would you use the baseball diamond that's down on the below the school? That would be appropriate for landing, surely.
Well, as a landing zone, that looked like it would be absolutely appropriate. Now, of course, the argument will be if we're looking for a second shooter, we don't want the helicopters landing in a, quote, hot landing zone. Okay, go to Google Earth. Pull back the map a little bit, and you will see several areas that are more than amenable to landing a helicopter where they are not in direct line of sight of a, quote, second shooter. Now, that would be perfectly fine if the entire access road was not clogged with vehicles. How are you going to move these patients out? You can't. Even if there were patients there, you cannot move them out. So who was the initial EMS commander? The Newtown First Aid Squad, Newtown Emergency Medical Services, is a volunteer department. Where was their incident commander? Where was their representative in the command post? At the initial dispatch, why did the first unit that signed on not say, as you're supposed to, as you are taught in the ICS program, this is ambulance 123. I am staging at the Newtown Firehouse. I have a potential MCI. Activate a level 1, 2, or 3 MCI response. Each community, each EMS service will have some way of communicating to the dispatcher that they have a potential MCI without saying, I need ambulances from this town, this town, this town, and this town. They tell them, for instance, the one department I worked, we had what was called like the fire department, we would have a first alarm, second alarm, third alarm medical, which would bring in different resources. If I got to a third alarm medical, I knew exactly how many advanced life support units I was getting, basic life support units I was getting, how many additional command structure folks was I getting, because it would bring me additional EMS commanders to the scene to assist with this. None of that happened there. We work pediatric cardiac arrests. Unless that child is disarticulated, transected their thoracic cavity through one of the planes, or is decapitated, we work pediatric patients. If for no other reason than to be able to look that parent in the eye and say, I am so sorry this happened to you and your family.
Boy, can I just get in quick and ask you a question?
Sure.
If anyone saw at that shooting, an infant, say a six-year-old, who looked as if they just had one shot through the lip, would you call air medical for that?
Generally, air medical will not take cardiac arrest patients, but I would make sure that that patient was a priority one trauma. They were either ground transported or air transported to a trauma center. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there was no medical assistant.
Wayne Carver claimed every child had between 3 and 11 shots, which is preposterous on its face all by itself. But that was what he claimed.
Okay, let's take a look at a six-year-old's body. Their average circulating volume is between somewhere between 3 and 4 liters of blood. If they had 11 wounds in a 4-foot body from a 5.56, the M885 round, which I am very familiar with as a U.S. Marine, there would be nothing that they would be unrecognizable, number one. Number two, where were these wounds located? If yeah. Even in a six-year-old, if they got shot 3 times, 2 in 1 leg and 1 in an arm, they have a great chance of survival. But we wouldn't know that because as a paramedic, we were denied, the EMS was denied access to the building, with the exception of 2 paramedics from Danbury Hospital who are tactical paramedics. Matt Casavecchia, who's the director of EMS at Danbury Hospital, his brother is a Connecticut State Trooper. The other medical personnel that went in there and performed the, quote, 4 rounds of triage were Connecticut State Police Troopers. What hat were they wearing? Were they in there as medical personnel? Were they in there as police officers? If they were in there as medical personnel, then you got to put on your paramedic hat, which means for every patient I come in contact with, I have to write a report. Could you imagine if I wrote a patient care report that said that I had a male patient of approximately 6 years of age, weighing approximately 40 kilograms of weight, that had what appeared to be penetrating trauma to the lower abdomen and the upper right arm, and the medical examiner's report differed with what I wrote? A patient care report that I write as a paramedic is a legal medical document. It's a legal document.
Roy, we have 10 minutes for the rest of your slides.
Okay, next slide, please. Look at here's a shot from the back of the firehouse. As we can see, there is haphazard staging of the ambulances that were there. There is no coordination. There's no staging area manager. No staging area manager. Even if I wanted to get people into those ambulances, how am I going to do that? Number one. Number two, you're concerned about privacy. Look at all these people wandering around there. Any one of them could have seen my patient. Next slide, slide, please. That is not how we do business. When we stage units, we stage them in an appropriate place in an orderly fashion so that we can transport patients to hospitals without being delayed. Next, please. So kids are not small adults. The protocols do differ. The golden hour we talked about, the first 60 minutes after the injury occurs, we want to have them into a trauma bay without undue delay. Trauma is a surgical disease. What I do as a paramedic is life-sustaining. It buys them time to get to a trauma unit. We work pediatric patients almost without fail, if we're allowed to have access to them. Next slide, please. So preservation of evidence and integrity of the crime scene should never, ever detract from treatment of the sick or injured. Why is it that EMS was not allowed into that building? As far as pronouncement of patients, generally what will happen is if I have a patient in the field that I'm going to pronounce, I can't do it on my own authority. I pick up a radio. I have telemetry with the hospital. I present my case to the attending physician at my command hospital, and based on the information that I provide, that doctor provides time of death. Now, I have worked with medical examiners and deputy coroners and asked them, have you ever seen a medical examiner change a time of death from that an attending physician in the ER pronounced the patient in the field? And they said they have never seen it unless they found something on autopsy that shows time of death was different than what we recorded. So I don't understand how you have time of death at 11 o'clock when the command physician in the hospital that was in contact with the field paramedics pronounced that patient dead at 10:35. I don't understand it. Next slide, please. And again, this is just showing the parking lot. What I want to show here is down on that lower right-hand corner, we see the red and yellow tarps. Those are for immediate patient would go on red, delayed patient would go on the yellow. But again, how am I going to get them up the road? The access road down Dickinson Drive was completely blocked with vehicles. I couldn't move patients out of there if I wanted to. And again, I wouldn't leave them out in December. It's 23 degrees ground temperature to die of hypothermia on a tarp.
28,
it's horrible.
So, Roy, in that situation, Roy, you are going to get copters in there. You're going to get choppers in there.
If I had patients that are that were what we call flight appropriate, absolutely. Even if I didn't have, for whatever reason, I couldn't use the landing zones around the school, if they were concerned about that landing zone being hot, then I would have found another landing zone. I would have done something. The problem is the law enforcement took that as a law enforcement only. EMS is not needed here. Everybody is dead. And the EMS incident commander never went up to the police commander and said, I have a job to do. I have a duty to act. Who are you to pronounce all of these people? Number one, there are 20 children in there. My protocols, if this is the protocol in that area, say I need to not only assess those patients, but I need to treat them. I need to treat them. How do you know they were all dead? You didn't triage any of these people an hour.
Roy, they were all pronounced at 12 o'clock by Carver.
Well, according to the report, Matt Casavecchia, who is the director of the paramedics at Danbury Hospital, was in communication with the attending physician at Danbury Hospital, did four triages, and elected not to resuscitate not one of those patients in there. And that was almost an hour later. So they blew their golden hour. There was no reason why, as a tactical paramedic, I could have come up with a plan and I could have had the resources there and said, okay, I need five cops. I need two police officers to secure this end of the hallway, two police officers at this end of the hallway, two police officers to go in with my paramedics to secure the room, clear the room, and provide them cover, just like we would in any other tactical environment, because I have the potential for 20 shot children in there and I need to do something about this. Otherwise, I'm not doing my job. So next slide, please. And again, another picture here of the parking lot. And as you pointed out, there is a perfect landing zone right down the bottom left-hand corner. Up in the front of the school, we can see on the roof there, almost where the hallway would be down the long axis. At the far end, which would be to the left side of the picture, there was an exit door. Why could we not bring ground ambulance through the parking lot up to that piece of McAdam, load a patient in, and send them right back out Dickinson Drive? Well, reason number one, it was completely blocked.
And to reiterate a point I made before, 28 degree ground temperature, no steam or heat coming from the building. The school had been abandoned by 2008. It was not an operating school. Once again, we have further proof that this was an elaborate hoax.
Right. And I am not buying it, because as a career paramedic with almost 30 years on the job, this is not how we do business. And I want the public to know that paramedics take their jobs very, very seriously. I am not a volunteer. This is what I do for a living. And I will do everything I possibly can to save someone's life. And that did not happen here. That did not happen here. It's horrible. Again, the only folks that really had any contact with the quote-unquote patients were all people that had some manner of connection to law enforcement, whether they were tactical paramedics that trained with law enforcement or they were the Connecticut state troopers that had some manner of medical training and certification. So I don't understand why, again, we were prevented. If we were concerned about a second shooter, EMS is a dangerous job. We take our lives in our hands every single day. We put the uniform on our back and the shield on our chest, just like any cop does.
Well,
and we have a job to do.
Can I venture to say something? I've known a few paramedics, and I found that they have a kind of integrity that, you know, is usually the sort of stuff between good priests and their flock kind of thing. I can't really see genuine paramedics being involved in this shenanigan. I can't see them going in there and pretending that they saw something they didn't.
Right. And if they were told, hey, this is a drill, this is a training event, as a paramedic, I'd love to get good training. I would love to be involved with it and take every opportunity I can to be involved in a good live training simulation. And we say we train like we fight like we train. So we try to make our training as realistic as possible. But if I went to a training scenario and someone later on came to me as a manager of a licensed EMS entity and said, hey, we want you and your folks to play this off like it really happened. We know that there was really no death or anything in there, but we want you to play it off like it was real. I'd look at them like they grew a third eye right in the middle of their forehead. You lost your rabbit mind. I can't do that. I can't
thank
real.
You enough. I want to make a few observations about what we've discovered here today, which confirms general principles of scientific reasoning, which includes that when you have an hypothesis that is true, as you conduct more and more experiments or studies from diverse points of view, you get further and further confirmation. I think in relation to the Santa Barbara event, that your being here demonstrates that when you're an expert, you can see things much more clearly than an amateur, that the general public would look at all those bodies, all that equipment, all that seeming whatever going on and be impressed thinking that was a real event. But you're here offering your expertise in diagnosing that manifestly it was not. And with regard to Sandy Hook, I'm just so pleased to have a bona fide paramedic available who can do some fine tuning to many arguments that have been made, but not as decisively as you have made them here. So I am extremely pleased to have you aboard, Roy. I look forward to bringing you back because there's so much more to discuss. I'd like to give a very brief moment to each of you to say a parting word. Alan first.
This latest ridiculous thing in San Bernardino, all of the ops are out, especially our old friend Philip Franklin, who I believe works for the Connecticut state government. He's telling everyone that it's a real thing, just like he does for Sandy Hook. Watch out for those ops. They'll try and tie you up in hours.
It's on blogs and so forth. Roy, would you like to say a word?
Yeah, just imparting, it's been an honor to be here to have this platform. And I want the public to know that your emergency medical services are there for you. We are there to help you. We hold ourselves to a very high standard of conduct. We do not like to be involved in nefarious things. We are consummate professionals. We are there so others may live. And to both of you gentlemen, this has been very, very enlightening and eye-opening for me also. So thank you very much.
We're getting more and more reason why the Obama administration, its press secretary, Jay Carney, having gone to Amazon.com as a senior vice president, had to suppress the Sandy Hook book. It even includes a chapter, an appendix demonstrating that when guns are banned, crime goes up for the obvious reason that the law-abiding citizens are deprived of any ability to defend themselves. California has been described as an open shooting range. This event in Santa Barbara, San Bernardino, appears to be blowing up in the face of the Obama administration, which is running more and more of these drills faked as real events as a psychological operation to batter the American people mentally into believing we must give up our guns. But the message is precisely the opposite. In this case, even if you take the official account at its face value, the terrorists are coming. If we don't have guns, we're not going to be able to defend ourselves. The Obama administration is left holding the bag on this one. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guests, Alan Powell and Roy DeSoto, for being here. And all of you for watching.